greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Thanks for tuning in this evening. Welcome to the sunny side of sports.
Stand up! Stand up! Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the sunny side of sports.
Yes, my friend.
The sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports.
The sunny side of sports show.
Great show, bro. This is sunny side of sports.
Sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up.
My guest on the show this evening is Alejandro Ali Danois, the editor-in-chief of the Shadow League sports website. And Ali is also the author of The Boys of Dunbar. We're going to talk about the book. But first, Ali, welcome to the sunny side of sports.
It's a pleasure to be here on the sunny side of sports, man. I must have really made the big time now.
Well, your book chronicles the story of the 1981-82 Dunbar Poets, one of the greatest high school basketball teams of all time. But before we get to the boys of Dunbar, Ali, let's talk about those men of the Golden State Warriors. They're also being called one of the great NBA teams of all time. Your thoughts on the Warriors?
I have enjoyed watching this team, not only this year, but this past run over the last 3 years has just been historically significant if you are not just a fan of basketball, but if you're a connoisseur and a student of the game and have watched some of the great teams that we've been blessed enough to witness, I'd say, since 1980. With the addition of Kevin Durant this year, I really didn't understand the backlash. I really didn't understand people questioning his decision. Now, I can look at it from another perspective and see the validity and why certain people would be all up in arms, but it was great to finally see him reach this amazing stage against one of the greatest basketball players of all time in LeBron James, and to see them line up against each other, to look each other in the eye. I loved every minute of it, and it was one of the most beautiful displays of basketball I've ever seen. I haven't seen anything resembling that offensive execution and beauty since the Showtime Lakers. And I'm just a fan of Steve Kerr, the system they run, the way that ball moves, how everyone accepts their role, just how unguardable they are. And I'm a fan of basketball excellence. And I was just blown away by what I saw with KD and the Warriors this year.
Two titles in the past 3 years for the Warriors. How long will their reign go, Ali?
I think it's realistic to say for the next 5 years, they'll be right in the mix individually when you see how this team has been constructed. Despite their superfluous talents, they're all very unselfish and they understand the end goal of winning and being on that stage, hoisting that O'Brien trophy. But we know that this is a business and there will be some things that come into play. Obviously, there will be some pieces that are added. There will be some pieces that are taken away. But when you look at the way they're constructed now, if they're able to keep these guys together for the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to be pretty tough to beat them.
I loved your book, The Boys of Dunbar. And early on, you describe yourself as a hoops fanatic. What was your inspiration to write The Boys of Dunbar?
I grew up in an environment in New York City where basketball was like a religion to us as kids. There was a basketball court behind my building that I grew up in, so I didn't have to go far to be in the middle of something that was just so beautiful to us as kids. We studied the game. We would read the box scores after every game. As 12 and 13-year-old kids, as most New Yorkers tend to be, we were loud and arrogant and thought we knew everything about the game. And one day we're out there just having this discussion of why New York City is the king of basketball. And we're talking about guys like Tiny Archibald, who was the only player to lead the NBA to this day in scoring and assists in the same season. Tiny was from the Bronx. The great Dr. J, Julius Erving, was from Long Island, and at that time he was exhibiting his aerial brilliance for the Philadelphia 76ers. Our favorite player was Bernard King, who played for the Knicks, and unfortunately we could never get past Larry Bird's Boston Celtics, but nevertheless we had an insatiable appetite for Knicks basketball and Bernard King. We talked about the great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who went down as the all-time leading scorer in NBA history, who was from Harlem. And so we're talking about all of these players and how it's so amazing that they're from New York. And we're also talking about the street legends that never made it but could have, like Earl the Goat Manigault, if he had stayed on the right path and not gotten caught up in drugs, and Pee Wee Kirkland, and so many of the other playground legends. And then there were guys who were teenagers who were older than us, who are our neighborhood superheroes. One of my neighbors was Lorenzo Charles, who was an All-American at Brooklyn Tech. Most people know that he went to North Carolina State and authored the ending to that miraculous NCAA championship game where he got the dunk in the final seconds to defeat the heavily favored University of Houston Phi Slamma Jamma Cougars with Hakeem Olajuwon. There was another guy in the neighborhood by the name of Dwayne the Pearl Washington, who was one of the most important recruits in Big East history, who just created magic with the basketball at Syracuse University. There was a guy by the name of Chris Mullen, who we saw shoot the basketball better than anybody we'd ever seen in a high school gym or a neighborhood park. And so we're talking about all of these guys, whether it's the high school guys or the college guys, the pro legends. And then there are guys our own age who we're hearing about, like this guy from Queens who they call Chibs or Kenny the Kid or Kenny Ice. He was Kenny Anderson, who went on to take Georgia Tech to the Final Four as a freshman, first team All-ACC as a freshman. So, you know, we're really hyped up on ourselves. And there's a guy who lived in our building who was a pretty good playground basketball player himself, who we always valued his opinion. And he was probably in his early 20s at the time. And he heard us talking and bragging about how New York was this and that and how we run basketball. And he just said, well, I got to tell you guys that the best team I ever saw was a high school team from Baltimore called Dunbar. And that kind of set me back a little bit because I'm watching Larry Bird and the Boston Celtics play some great basketball. I'm watching Moses Malone and Dr. J with the Philadelphia 76ers. I'm watching Magic with this Showtime phenomenon. And I'm saying, that's the best team you ever saw? And he says, yeah. So we start asking him questions, you know, what is it about this team? So he'd gone to the Harlem Holiday Classic and saw them play. And he started breaking down just how talented they were. He said that everyone on the team would play major Division I basketball on a scholarship, even the guys who never got into the game, and that they had the number one player in the country by the name of Reggie Williams. And he said, you know, wait till he gets to college. You're not going to believe everything that this guy can do. He can play guard. He can play forward. He can play defense. He can block shots. He can pass. There isn't any shot on the court that he can't make. I mean, he's the number one player in the country. And then he said something that really piqued my interest. He said, but he's not even the best player on his own team. And so we said, well, how can the number one high school player in the country not be the best player on his own team? So who's the best player? And he says, you're not going to believe me when I tell you. So we said, come on, man, you know, you got to give it to us. Who's the best player on the team who plays with the number one high school player? He says, you're not going to believe me. So finally, we got on his nerves enough. He said, all right, I'm going to tell you, but I'm telling you, you're not going to believe me. The best player on that team is a 5-foot midget.
Okay.
And his name is Bugsy. He called him Bugsy with a B. And we thought he was pulling our leg. We thought he was lying to us. Yeah, right. A 5-foot midget is better than the number one high school player in the country. And so that's really, Sonny, where the seed was planted for me when I was 12 or 13 years old. Fast forward a couple of years later, I'm watching this new innovative cable network that has this idea of 24-hour sports programming. And I tune into a Wake Forest University basketball game, and I hear the announcer say something about this 5'3" mercurial point guard from Baltimore – by the name of Muggsy Bogues. And I almost fell out of my chair and I yelled to no one in particular, "That's Bugsy!" Right? And so I saw Muggsy at Wake Forest, and I'd never seen anyone be able to dominate a game the way that he did without having to score a point. I'm watching Reggie Lewis now at the crescendo of the Hoyer paranoia phenomenon at Georgetown. I see David Wingate playing on that Georgetown team, and I find out that he was a teammate on that Dunbar team. At the time, I was in a prep school up in Massachusetts on a scholarship for talented minority students, and there was a guy at Northeastern University who just had the local basketball scene on fire. And so my buddies and I would hop on the tee, and we would go to the Boston Garden and the Northeastern Gym to watch this guy by the name of Reggie Lewis, who was all nerve and sinew, and he looked skinny and frail before the game tipped off, but he was utterly unstoppable. And so my interest was piqued when I heard, you know, this guy couldn't even start for his own high school team. And I said, that's ridiculous. He's one of the best college players in the country. How could he not start? And sure enough, I found out that he was a part of this great Dunbar team that I heard about in my New York City playground debates. So I was kind of hooked from then, man. I'd read the box scores of every game, and I started to ask myself questions like, what did this team look like? What was it like going to school in Baltimore? I had all of these questions, and it wasn't until, you know, years later that I merged my passion with sports with my love for the written word. I'm now a sports writer. I'm writing stories, and I'm sending out pitches. And this idea just kept knocking and just kept hitting me. And I said, you know, I got to do something about this team.
For Voice of America listeners just tuning in, I'm chatting with Alejandro Ali Danois, author of The Boys of Dunbar. The front cover of the book, Ali, describes your tale as a story of love, hope, and basketball. And after reading that book, I think much of the love and hope came from the coach of that Dunbar team, Bob Wade. Your thoughts on Coach Wade?
It's through Wade's personal life journey that you get a sense for the power of what was going on in that gymnasium. And I'm not just talking about the basketball. One of the things, Sonny, that really hit me as I was doing my research to write the book was how important the character of Baltimore itself was going to be. I went into this thinking I was just writing a basketball story. And the more research that I did and the more I learned about Bob Wade and what he represented, it hit me that I was writing about something that was so much bigger. So when we look at Bob Wade's story, his story is emblematic of the millions of people whose families left the explosive racial powder keg of the South during a movement where people were looking to go to what they called the Promised Land. And down south, when the agrarian economy died, you had what was called the Great Northern Migration. Wade's parents left a very small tobacco farming town of Dilwyn, Virginia, in search of their own slice of the American pie, where you could go to a place like Philadelphia or St. Louis or Baltimore, and you could get a decent union wage without having an elevated education level. And so Bob Wade's father comes up as part of this movement, the numbers of which dwarfed the European immigrants that landed at Ellis Island. He comes to Baltimore and he gets a job in the steel mills, and he's able to bring his family up here to Baltimore. And it was really a time of hope where people felt like they were going to be able to get their individual slice of the American dream. And unfortunately, when Wade is very young, his father comes to symbolize the cowardly man who leaves his family, basically tells his mom, "Hey, I'm going out to get a pack of cigarettes," and never comes back. And so now mom has very little education. She's the head of the household, homemaker, but now she's got to figure out how to feed her children, keep this roof over their heads, and navigate a treacherous path now that the main wage earner and the father and the man of the house is gone. And so you see through her strength how she's able to keep things together, how she pools her resources with her relatives that also came up from the cotton and tobacco patches of the South, and she makes it happen. She's constantly telling Wade how education is going to be the passport to his future. He turns out to be a very gifted athlete who gets a scholarship to play college football, but his mom is constantly telling him that she doesn't want him to work in a textile factory and that school is where he needs to be at his most competitive. So the rivalries around the house among the cousins and the siblings wasn't around who had the fanciest clothes or who was dating the prettiest girl. It was around who got their most A's on their report card. Wade goes on to play at Morgan State University. He gets drafted by the Baltimore Colts. He winds up playing in the National Football League for 4 years, but he suffers an injury as a shattered wrist and as a defensive back that basically makes him a liability. So a couple of years after being the runner-up to the NFL Rookie of the Year, this guy's out of the league. But he had the foresight to say, when I'm done playing football, I want to go back to my community and make a difference in the same way that my role models, that his high school coach, the legendary William Sugar Cane, made an impact. So he was very much an educator who valued what athletics could do for a young man who had some talent and how that could propel them to spaces and places that they never dreamed before. He was the ultimate taskmaster. He could be very brutal and rough and direct, but he loved Baltimore. He loved Dunbar High School, and he loved those kids. And the element of family runs through the book because Wade was a product of Dunbar High School. He was a product of the community. So he knew the parents of his players before those guys were even born, right? He coached their siblings. When they were little kids, they would walk into the gym, and he would pat them on the head and joke around with them saying, all right, how many years until you guys are going to be playing for me? Not knowing what they would develop into. And then you also had this other family element, because when you look at the relationship of Muggsy Bogues and Reggie Williams, those guys were best friends since they were toddlers. Their love for one another wasn't forged by them becoming elite basketball prospects. They were riding their skateboards around the neighborhood. They were riding their roller skates while holding on to city buses. They were at the recreation centers doing arts and crafts activities and practicing the latest dances. It wasn't until later that basketball came into the picture. So these guys were eating at the same dinner tables before they showed a hint of promise. And when they would go to the basketball courts and the older guys would shoo them off, they'd have their own games in the back alleys playing on milk crates. So this wasn't a team that was recruited, that was thrown together. These were guys who had known or known of one another, who had competed with and against one another since the earliest days in this incubator of the recreation centers in Baltimore. So it's a very deep lineage when you look at kind of how this team came together, the families that came before them, and the relationships that were forged before they even got to Dunbar.
For our VOA listeners just tuning in, I'm talking with Alejandro Ali Danwa, author of The Boys of Dunbar. Ali, as you point out in the book, four members of that Dunbar team made it to the NBA: Muggsy Bogues, Reggie Williams, David Wingate, and the late Reggie Lewis. Maybe the most tragic of those players who made it to the NBA.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the very, very sad elements, not only in the book, but when you look back historically at what he was accomplishing, what he was on the verge of accomplishing. Remember, Reggie didn't start for the team at Dunbar. And the lazy narrative is, well, he wasn't good enough to start for his own high school team. And Wade says, no, he was every bit as talented. And he debated whether he should start him. But think about this. The starting center was a guy by the name of Tim Dawson, who was a shot-blocking and rebounding phenom. And every chance he got, he was trying to rip down the rim with a thunderous dunk. And you have Reggie Williams and David Wingate and all of this talent. And so you're the opposing team. You're getting your brains beat out one of their best players goes to the bench, you're losing by 30, and you take a sigh of relief saying, all right, well, now maybe we've got a chance to close the gap. And then Truck comes in, and they actually get better. I mean, that had to be demoralizing. But, you know, he didn't start, and that also speaks to Wade's acumen as a teacher and as a coach and as a leader into getting people to be unselfish. I mean, we started off talking about this great Golden State Warriors construct and how unselfish this team is and how that allows them to reach a pinnacle of the sport. And I think you have that very same element within this Dunbar team, in that Bob Wade could convince a player of Reggie Lewis's caliber to come off the bench and do what was best for the team. Reggie goes on to supplant the legendary Larry Bird as the captain of the fabled Boston Celtics franchise. And unfortunately, he died of a heart defect at the tender age of 27. For the guy who didn't start for his high school team that had this miraculous collection of talent, he went on to probably become the best player out of all of them. But it's really cool for people who don't know the background story to kind of get a sense of who Truck was in high school. You know, they called him Cookie Monster because he always had a pack of cookies in his pocket. And, you know, he was very quiet and very shy and very soft-spoken. But such determination to prove that he could accomplish things, because the year prior to coming to Dunbar, he got cut by the coach at Patterson High School. And Wade got a tip from a guy by the name of Anthony Duty Lewis, who was one of the great mentors in the recreation program at the Cecil Kirk program, which later produced Rudy Gay and so many other great players. Duty calls Wade and says, look, man, I got a guy coming over to Dunbar. He's really good. I want you to, you know, give him a look. And Wade was hesitant. He said, well, how can this guy be good if he got cut by Patterson? And he watches them in the summertime, and he calls up Anthony Lewis, and he said, man, that coach at Patterson must be crazy to cut that kid. But he had this work ethic and this desire, and then you look back into kind of his family struggles. Just so many elements and layers to the story, and Reggie Lewis is definitely one of the fascinating ones.
Maybe wrap it up with Muggsy, the best player on the team. I feel like you had special affection for Muggsy after completing the book.
I did, and Muggsy, in my opinion, is the most revolutionary basketball talent we've ever seen. Michael Jordan, one of the greatest all time. We've already seen a reasonable facsimile of him in Kobe Bryant. We've seen the next level of what Magic Johnson is and was now in LeBron James. I think we will see 10 more Michael Jordans before we see another Muggsy Bogues, the shortest player ever in the history of the NBA, who just could make such a profound impact with his passing and with his leadership. Muggsy, to me, is the greatest underdog story in the history of sports. Rocky was a fictional character. He's got his own statue in Philadelphia. Rudy played one snap at Notre Dame, and he's got a great movie that was made about him. Muggsy played 15 years in the NBA at such a level at his size that we'll never see again. And the book really kind of gives you some insight into the leader that he was, the person that he was, the personal struggles, and kind of everything that went into making him who he became. So I really appreciate you taking the time to have me on to talk about the book. And people who have read it, even if they aren't into sports, are really liking it, and it's resonating because it's a sports story that's about so much more than sports. It touches on crime, sociology, so many different levels and layers. The city of Baltimore is a major character, and people are really starting to take to it.
Thanks, Ali. That's Alejandro Ali Danois, the author of The Boys of Dunbar. And Ali was talking with us from the home of the Boys of Dunbar, Baltimore, Maryland. And that wraps up the June 20th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Thanks to Voice of America producer Bill Werkinger. Thanks also to VOA engineer Thomas Blondet. And thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports.
I did. get it.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On June 20th, we observe World Refugee Day. It is an occasion to highlight the plight of refugees around the world, commend their resilience, and express gratitude to their hosts. According to the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees, a refugee is someone who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his nationality and is unable to, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to avail himself of the protection of that country. In 2016, the world's refugee population topped 22 million, more than ever before. The displaced come from all walks of life, singly and in families, across a wide spectrum of ethnic, religious, economic, and educational backgrounds. But they have one thing in common. All have been forced from their homes and homelands. They flee to escape persecution or violent conflict, including terrorism. Often people flee because their towns have been turned into battlefields, and staying means nearly certain death. This is a global crisis that is affecting more men, women, and children than ever before, and for longer and longer periods of time. As we observe World Refugee Day, we are reminded that as long as violence and persecution continue, there will be a pressing need for comprehensive humanitarian action and a global response. That is why the United States is proud to continue its leadership in providing humanitarian aid around the world. This life-saving assistance protects refugees, feeds those who might otherwise starve, shelters those who would otherwise be exposed to the elements, and ensures access to safe, clean water and basic health care. As U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "We are committed to easing the suffering of Syrian refugees and supporting the countries that host them. In the face of dire needs, horrible violence, and unbearable persecution, our commitment to the world's most vulnerable people remains a critical component of U.S. policy."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Lenore Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next, Straight Talk Africa, a preview of the Kenyan presidential election. The race between incumbent Uhuru Kenyatta and Raila Odinga. The main opposition candidate is looking increasingly competitive. A discussion on Kenya's presidential election on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
African music mix.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African music mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast comes to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.